As a physician, I've been in crisis areas and disasters for the past 12 years. This is the worst I've seen. And I'm really fearful for the Palestinian people and the children that have no connection to what happened in Israel. They're not responsible for what happened in Israel. The situation is beyond catastrophe. And I urge our government, because they are the only party that is able to stop this hell that is raining on Gaza.
President Zaha Salul, I want to thank you for being with us. President and CEO of Med Global, speaking to us from Chicago. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a video news production fellow. Learn more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Noreen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Malkoff, Tay Marie Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Sanji Lopez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Policy and Governance Committee meets on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if our meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of the Día de los Muertos celebration on Wednesday, November 1st, from 12 to 10 p.m. at The Red on Salmon Street in Portland. Día de los Muertos is an ancient celebration originating from the indigenous people of Mexico. Festivities will include altar creation, muertos face painting, sugar skull decorating, traditional Mexican food, and live musical performances. Again, that's the Día de los Muertos celebration on Wednesday, November 1st, from 12 to 10 p.m. at The Red on Salmon Street, 831 Southeast Salmon Street in Portland.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8:03. I'm Althea, one of the hosts of The Gap. Regrettably, informing you we don't have a show this morning, but I do want to come in and say thank you to some of our most recent donors in our fall membership drive. Ben N, to anonymous folks, Corinne M, and GGL. Thank you so much for supporting KBOO. We are your community connection here, and we can't make it happen without your support. Now is a great time to join. Become a member at kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to 44321. Instead, here we've got a special episode of Row on the Rocks. Stay with us.
Change the way we change the way we approach the rest of the world. So I want to thank you, Michael, for the work that you're doing. Thanks for being an activist. Yeah.
Thank you.
Since July.
In the U.S.
about how this is the only organization Morning Row podcast.
Oh, what a world! KBOO 90.7. Dasha T said that.
Welcome back to Row on the Rocks, a limited series podcast where I take you through what abortion access looked like in America and the months leading up to the U.S. Supreme Court overturning Roe. Last time on the show, I spoke with a legal expert at the ACLU of Florida about the state's 15-week abortion ban, a ban that has now been in effect since July. Before Roe was overturned, as states like Texas were passing abortion bans, many women and people who can become pregnant turned to virtual healthcare services, also known as telehealth. Today I'm speaking with Robin Tucker, a clinician with Aid Access, the only organization that currently provides abortion pills through telehealth in all states throughout the U.S., including states where abortion is banned or seriously restricted. Now here's Robin Tucker in our conversation that was recorded last spring about how the service works.
So Aid Access is a bunch of clinicians like me. Some of us are based in the U.S. and we prescribe for whatever patients do an online consult with Aid Access who are in the state we are licensed in. So I do Virginia and Maryland and Maine, prescriptions. And there is a clinician in Europe that handles the consults for patients who are in the more restrictive states. And so she is operating under the laws where she lives and she's protected. So the prescription is written from a clinician outside the U.S. and it's sent from a pharmacy outside the U.S. So we're the only organization that's currently operating that is sending pills to all of the states.
Getting into the abortion pills themselves, there are all kinds of information and misinformation out there. Can you explain how misoprostol and then misoprostol, how they each work? From what I understand from previous conversations with clinicians, it's a two-step pill process. So yeah, if you could just explain how that works.
Yeah. So misoprostol is a progesterone blocker. So what it does is it has a molecule in it that binds to your progesterone receptors so that progesterone doesn't get to the placenta to continue the pregnancy. And so that's step one. The misoprostol works by causing uterine contractions. And it's funny, we actually use misoprostol as well to induce people's labor when they're giving birth, for example. So it's a widespread use medication, but it basically makes the uterus contract. And so it kind of makes everything come out.
Got it. And there's all, like I said earlier, there's different kinds of misinformation out there. And a very core and consistent thing I've heard from our medical providers who specifically work in gynecology or reproductive health care is that these two pills that we're discussing right now, in their words, are incredibly safe and safer than other commonly used medication taken every day, like Tylenol. Can you kind of expand on that? I think a lot of folks who either don't have the personal experience or don't know a lot about this subject in regards to abortion healthcare think of these as very scary forms of medication.
Right. And it sounds, abortion is very taboo.
Right.
And so it sounds kind of crazy, that one of the medications would be safe. A lot of the blocks on this drug have been due to political issues and not necessarily due to the safety record. And you can go to the FDA website and review, all of the information that they looked at about risk compared to that and some other medications. And it's very educational. Just the number of people who've had adverse events is so low. Most of the side effects from these pills are uncomfortable or unusual for the person experiencing them, but not medically dangerous.
And at the same time, you know, something that I've read in research is that as much as organizations like yours is a form of expanding access, it is not necessarily an option for everyone in terms of medical conditions, like someone who might have a bleeding disorder. Can you talk about how this organization, those like yours, is providing an essential form of access, but at the same time, there are still barriers for folks seeking abortion healthcare services.
Yes, and you know, pills aren't perfect for everyone. You know, they're not going to help in every scenario. One thing, like you talked about, bleeding disorders. If you have a bleeding disorder, it's most likely safer for you to have a procedure, because then when the tissue comes out, they can monitor what your body's doing and make sure you're not losing too much blood. And with a medication abortion, the tissue works its way out, you know, and you're not, you don't have anyone kind of watching your blood loss. And so it can be more optimal to have that done. There's a couple of other things, like if someone has a sensitivity to prostaglandins, they shouldn't take these pills. If they have, you know, an allergy to any of the medicines, they shouldn't take these pills. If they have any adrenal conditions or like chronic steroid use, they shouldn't take these pills. There's a few things like that. But they're not very common. Most people can take these pills safely. The contraindications are not extremely common.
And something that I've heard, I understand you're coming from a clinician standpoint, obviously, and not necessarily as an activist in any way. But if you can speak to my next question, something I've heard from folks who are anti-abortion is that the upcoming decision on the Mississippi Supreme Court case is that, as we are most likely going to see Roe either overturned or very much weakened, that the impact won't be that great given organizations like yours, where abortion pills are going to be, and already are, very accessible. Basically that this is a non-issue. Can you speak from your experience at Aid Access and even before that? What would your response be to that sort of mindset, that this is a non-issue because with modern day technology, menstruators, folks who become pregnant, have so much access already?
Well, I disagree that it's a non-issue, because I think something that is a big deal right now is how confused people are. We get lots of clients who have no idea what's legal anymore. Even if they're in a state without a lot of restrictions, they have no idea. All they've read is like abortion's illegal now. So there's a lot of confusion about that. There's a lot of confusion about what exactly is illegal in Texas and what is going on in Texas. Just from a layperson's perspective, you know, because a lot, these legal situations are actually complex, and trying to explain that the Texas law is different because the enforcement mechanism is the citizens instead of the government, actually you lose people already. They don't understand what is legal and what's not already. So I feel like making it more restricted, I think no matter what happens, there's going to be more confusion on behalf of the clients, and that's really unfortunate. But I also feel like there's kind of a chilling effect where people, even in protected states, are kind of afraid. Like, people don't want to tell people in the ER that they took pills, even if they're in a state where it's perfectly legal. And it's, you know, because they read about this stuff going on. And I think to a normal person, it's inconceivable that Texas, you know, would be that different than living here, because we're all in America. You know, and that's happening in modern day America. So I think there's a lot of, people are very afraid. And so I think it'll create even more of a chilling effect of people being afraid that they'll be found out. We've had a large surge in people obtaining the medications before they're pregnant, because they're afraid of what is going to happen.
And is that something that Aid Access can provide by?
Yes.
Okay. So you could essentially stock up on as much as you could, as you would like, or as much as that is offered.
Right. So, and we do advise people who get pills in advance that, that they should fill out a consult when they do get pregnant, so that, you know, cause they're paying for the pills and the clinician consult. You know, then once you get pregnant, you're still our patient. We've supplied the pills. We can help you make sure your dating is correct for the pregnancy, make sure you're still a good candidate to safely take the pills. So that's kind of the guidance that we're giving people. And, you know, it's, I think a lot of people in states where it's potentially a little less safe, like there's still abortion access, but it's kind of hanging on a thread, like Virginia, people are very afraid. There's a lot of those people getting pills before they're pregnant. And, you know, we explain what our recommendation is. And that's, you know, that's what we do.
Yeah, no, I think that was an important clarification that you made.
Yeah.
Which is that it's not like ordering, you didn't put it this way, but I'm kind of taking from what you just said, which is it's not like ordering, say, something on Amazon where it's a one-time transaction. Right. You know, there you state you are a clinician working with a patient, so there's ongoing conversation and checking in.
Right. So we like to differentiate this service from places like, if you go to Plan C, you can see in every state they have like direct-to-consumer pharmacy options where you can order your pills, you can just purchase them from an overseas pharmacy and have them mailed. And so we're a little different because everybody who gets a consult with us, it's reviewed medically by our clinician team. And it's prescribed. So we kind of, we feel like it's not necessarily better because sometimes people do need to go get the pills the other way, but it's different in that it's a medical care consult you're purchasing and not just pills.
For sure. And I think that's also important for listeners to understand that, you know, I think a lot of folks might be kind of skeptical at first without some of this context that you're providing that, you know, people are taking these pills. There's no sort of medical supervision or oversight, however you would like to put that. You know, basically that something could go wrong and no one would know.
Yeah, and there is kind of a perception that getting abortion pills online, even from a clinician consult, there's kind of a perception that it's sketchy. And, you know, we've been doing a lot of education. Plan C has been doing a lot of education to try and kind of counter that idea. Because, you know, I offer these services with Aid Access, and I also have an office I work in and, you know, like a bricks and mortar clinic, you know, so it's not, for example, like one of the work against is the idea that getting your pills online after working with a clinician is inferior than going to an office.
And then I'd like to go into something a little different. You mentioned earlier about folks having, like, folks who are in states maybe like mine. I'm reporting from Portland, Oregon, mm-hmm. that states like mine, there are folks who are going to the hospital and needing medical attention. They're experiencing maybe some type of complication, but they're not sharing what that is about, specifically related to abortion, because of the fear of what's going on across the country. Can you talk about what there are some common barriers that you see with your patients, whether that be financial, geographical?
We do see a lot of financial barriers. I see a lot of people who waited and they're like almost at the end of the window to get a medication abortion because they've been waiting to get the money together. Mm-hmm. And like Aid Access is a pay what you can model. So like if you say I need an abortion and I only have $20, then we only charge you $20. And so something I really try and encourage people to not think of it as like I'm trying to save up for it, because it's really better for you to be able to figure it out sooner rather than later. And the organizations are able to work with you. There's abortion funds if you go to other clinics. But I would say getting emergency care, some of it, you know, I feel like even in states where people are not restricted from abortion access as much, people still report that they're treated pretty badly when they, if they tell people that they took pills after getting a telehealth consult. I think a lot of the medical establishment has not really caught up to what's going on in the reproductive health landscape. But the thing I tell people is there's no drug test, there's no tox screen for these medications. Like, there's literally no such thing. And there's no way that we would be able to tell that you took them unless you disclose that. So, you know, what you're doing is inducing a miscarriage. And if you go get care at an ER, there is no way for them to tell if that is a miscarriage that happened on its own or if it was a miscarriage that happened after you took pills.
That's interesting. That's something I've read in other reports, specifically The Atlantic magazine. And their recent reporting is that folks are going in and have gone in previous years, that it's become very common for folks who are needing immediate medical attention to not say they're having an abortion and to instead say they're experiencing a miscarriage. And then, as you just said, they both look the same, whether you just try to self-induce an abortion or experiencing a miscarriage, that medically they look the same for the most part.
Right. And, you know, if people are uncomfortable, what they feel like is, you know, lying, you know, I've told people, you can say, you know, hey, I was pregnant, I had a positive pregnancy test, now I'm having all this bleeding. Like, you know, there's lots of ways to approach that. You know, but the risks of having a miscarriage are identical to the risks of having a miscarriage, a medication abortion, at the same gestational age. You know, it's really, the management is the same medically. The concerns are the same medically. So there's not necessarily any reason that anyone would need to know.
And you mentioned that you have heard quite often that folks in states where abortion is legal, that folks are having negative interactions with medical providers. Can you talk more about what that is, what you've heard?
Yeah.
And you said that there needs to be essentially some reform, that there needs to be some education on the part of the medical field.
Yes. Well, one of the things that we worry about most, and by we, I mean people in the abortion spaces, you know, we anticipate seeing greater numbers of people self-managing, either with pills or in other ways, and obtaining medical care and having these medical providers not want to treat them if they're in an aiding and abetting state, or possibly not having experience managing abortion and not sure how to manage the complications. You know, so we're trying to improve just the basic competency level of people following up on abortion care, where even if it's not self-managed abortion, maybe it's telehealth abortion that where the person doesn't live close to the provider. Like, if I had a patient in very rural area of Virginia that was nowhere near me and couldn't come to me for follow-up, you know, it wouldn't. It's very interesting to me how providers just don't want to have anything to do with it if the person says they took abortion pills, but they would treat someone with a miscarriage, which is the same bodily process, without a second thought. So it's just one of those things we're trying to get more people on board with. There's a perception that since this is a complication of an abortion, you should go to the original person. But if someone is worried that they need emergency care, you can't just send them back to, you know, you're kind of under an obligation to take care of them. But I've had people kind of say, oh, you just got pills off the internet then, huh? Like, you know, and people are like, oh, but I talked to a clinician, I worked with a, it's very interesting.
And kind of on that note, you know, we aren't talking about anyone in a specific community other than someone who is experiencing a complication with a self-managed abortion or miscarriage. But I'm wondering, can you kind of expand on what that's like for someone who may be in an already underserved and mistreated community, often mistreated community, like someone who is a person of color or LGBTQ? How something like aid access helps kind of mitigate maybe some of those experiences with unkind medical professionals.
Well, and the thing we have to remember is that most of the people getting abortions already have kids. And so these are people who would have to find childcare, potentially take time off of work, potentially get transportation to another area. Just a lot of things that would go into the process of having an abortion before the telehealth was a reality. We get so many people who are just so appreciative of the fact that they didn't have to, you know, go to a clinic, walk past protesters yelling at them, you know, take time off work, have to find a babysitter, have to tell their family what's going on. All sorts of stuff that it's just more private and they feel more dignified being able to decide, you know, what day I'm doing this, when I'm doing it while I'm at home on my day off type of thing.
For sure. And I think, you know, like what you're talking about a lot, I've heard that consistently and read that consistently, that many folks seeking abortion healthcare services already have children.
Right.
And that this is an essential service that they need in terms of managing their own family.
Right.
Something that I'm curious about, and I've heard consistently from advocacy groups and activists, is a general frustration with folks like myself who are reporting on this with kind of this naive and shocked response to what's happening or what has been happening with the U.S. Supreme Court case. And what I mean by that is a lot of activists and advocates are saying, hey, this has been happening for decades. Roe's been chipped away at for decades now. And many folks in states throughout the country have been facing all kinds of barriers that we've been discussing, whether it be financial, geographical, childcare, and so on. Can you talk about your experience with what I'm saying in terms of there having been barriers for quite a while now, even before the Supreme Court case?
Right. Yeah, so my experience, I do see a lot of people who have a lot of difficulty with the expense. You know, a lot of states, Medicaid doesn't cover it. A lot of states, you know, a lot of private insurances don't cover it, or people don't want their parents to know, have it on their insurance, that kind of stuff. So, being able to kind of meet those people where they are and say, here's what we can offer you, that really breaks down barriers. We do need to improve on some things. Like, obviously, pills are not going to be ideal for people who are unhoused, for example, like if people who don't have a safe place to take the pills. One organization that I know is actually, they have a funding program where they pay for travel expenses to Virginia, and then they pay for a local hotel for someone to pass the pregnancy after they take pills. So things like that are definitely kind of looking at further breaking down barriers, because also, like, if someone's in an abusive situation, you know, we worry that, you know, what if the pills come when the client isn't home, but their abusive partner is? You know, there are certain things where we don't have the best way of breaking down barriers, and we're kind of trying to reach as many people as we can.
Without being overly pessimistic or fear-mongering, What are the consequences of that then, with the likelihood of Roe being overturned and abortion being illegal, or effectively being illegal in many states, and there being situations like yours where accessing an abortion procedure is just in no way an option, even with states like Oregon or California and so on, where abortion is legal? What does that mean for folks?
Well, it's scary. I mean, there are places right now where I know that people go to Virginia and get pills, you know, from over the border. Virginia borders on Tennessee, Kentucky, North Carolina, and West Virginia, and those are all extremely restrictive states. So, you know, those people are fortunate to live close to Virginia right now. But Texas is a gargantuan state, and trying to figure out how to get out of Texas to get to somewhere friendly is terrifying, because that can mean days of travel. So we do kind of anticipate more people self-managing, potentially in ways that are maybe unsafe. We're trying to promote, you know, safe access to pills via aid access or via pharmacies. But if people don't know about it, they're not going to get them.
This is Claire Rosciato with KBFM, and you're listening to Roe on the Rocks, a limited series podcast about what abortion access looked like in America while Roe was still the law of the land. Music in this segment is Ragtime by Peerless, courtesy of Epidemic Sound. Tune in next Thursday at 9 a.m. for the last episode of this podcast. Welcome back to Roe on the Rocks, a limited series podcast about what abortion access looked like in America before Roe was overturned. Last time on the show, I spoke with a telehealth clinician about their experience providing virtual abortion healthcare services and how this removes barriers for patients across the country living in states where abortion is seriously restricted or completely banned. Today, I'm speaking with Elisa Wells, the co-founder and co-director of Plan C, an online resource for at-home and self-managed abortions, about how virtual telehealth actually works.
Well, I just want to help people understand that Plan C doesn't actually provide pills, and there's no such brand as a Plan C pill, even though we're somewhat becoming a household term these days. Mainly, we're marketing the idea that there is a pill that you can take when your period is late. You know, Plan A is contraception, if you had access to it. Plan B is emergency contraception, which can work, you know, just after having unprotected intercourse if you haven't had a way of using contraception. And Plan C are, you know, is a method you can take when your period is late, if Plans A and Plan B didn't work. But what we know is a lot of folks don't even know about medication abortion and that these pills exist. And then people also really don't know that you can get the pills by mail through telehealth. This has been a real innovation during the pandemic, and there are now mainstream telehealth services in about half the country. Those are the states in which it's allowed by law to happen, and there are these amazing companies that are out there: Hey Jane, Carafem, Abortion on Demand, Pills by Post, Forward Midwifery, Choice, Just the Pill. I mean, there's all sorts of innovative providers out there that are offering really patient-centered care. Oregon and Washington both have mainstream telehealth providers. So in both states, you really don't have to go anywhere other than your computer or your phone in order to get abortion care. So that's something that we think a lot of people don't even know about. And so part of our goal is to spread the word about that. We have a guide to finding pills at our website, planzpills.org, and it is a state-by-state directory of what's available. It's all based on research. And for someone who lives in a state like Oregon or Washington, you'll go to it and you'll find some of these mainstream telehealth providers. But what if you live in a state like Texas, which is, you know, cutting off all access to care, or Oklahoma, total abortion ban there? What will you find there? Well, part of what we do is we research alternate routes of access. So how are people finding pills? And we know that there is access in all 50 states, despite politicians and bans. Aid Access, which is aidaccess.org, is a verified service that is providing telehealth medication, but the doctor sits in Amsterdam, and the pills are shipped from India. So it is a verified, trusted source of pills, and they charge $105, or they will discount the price down to zero if people can't afford it. One of the drawbacks to Aid Access is that it's, not a mainstream provider, and the pills are shipped from India, so they could take 2 or 3 weeks to get to you. But often that's the same time frame that people might be looking at to get to in-clinic care, especially in states that have so few clinics and such high demand. There are also these online pharmacies that are out there, and we've done research on those as well. These are just independent businesses that ship medication abortion pills to people in all 50 states. They're a little bit more expensive. They're not physician supervised. They're not necessarily regulated in any way, but we have purchased from them. We have assayed the products that we've received just to make sure that they are real products. And we do believe it's a viable way to for people to access abortion pills in the US, especially if they live in a state where access is limited. Another way we know people are accessing pills is by using virtual mailboxes or mail forwarding services. So for example, if you live in Alabama, which does not allow telehealth and you need care, you could go to a neighboring state or any of the states that allow telehealth abortion, and you could set up a virtual mailbox there using a service like PostScan Mail. Or, there's many different services. PostScan Mail is one that we have investigated and work well. And then you could do a telehealth consultation in California or in New York and give them the address in the state. You'd set up the virtual address in the same state that has the telehealth, because they're required to serve you in that state. That's what their licensing enables them to do. So they have to mail the pills to the state that they're licensed in. So you give them your virtual mailbox in that state, and then when you get the announcement from the service that you've got mail, you forward it to yourself at your home address.
Interesting.
We know people are doing that, and we provide really detailed information about how we know people are doing that to access mainstream telehealth services in the United States. These are by licensed providers with the FDA-approved product. And the pricing starts at about $150 for that. And many of them also can offer discounts for people who can't pay. So that's a real interesting way that we know people are accessing pills in the United States. And then the other way that we know people are getting pills is that they're getting them now to have on hand just in case. It's not uncommon for people to find themselves pregnant when they weren't expecting to. In fact, about 50% of all pregnancies are unplanned. So why not have the medication that you would need, to have it on hand in your medicine cabinet? And in much the same way that we encourage people to have Plan B or emergency contraception in your medicine cabinet, because you need to use that fairly quickly after unprotected intercourse. For abortion pills, if it's going to take 2 or 3 weeks to get it from Aid Access in India, why not get it now, have it in your medicine cabinet, and then when your period's late, there's something you can do to take immediate action.
Yes, you heard correctly earlier. Women and people who can become pregnant living in states where telehealth is banned or seriously restricted can set up virtual mailboxes in order to access abortion pills. Now, here's a little bit more about how this actually works.
We've been researching this just this last couple weeks, so it's fresh in my mind. So somebody sitting in Alabama, which does not allow telemedicine abortion, that person can go to a virtual mailbox service like PostScan Mail and apply for an address in a state that allows telemedicine. Let's use California as the example, because there are lots of telemedicine providers in California. So you go to PostScan Mail and you say, I want to get an address in California. and you look, and there are different addresses. Sometimes they're different prices. I've noticed that you could get an address on Rodeo Drive if you pay a lot of money. But really, you don't need that. You just need whatever the basic level of service is. It's probably going to be about $15. You also need to fill out some paperwork in order to set this up, and they do require a notary service, which they embed in their service, so it's all fairly seamless, but you have to pay a notary fee, so that's $20. So now we're up to $35 is the cost of this service for 1 month to rent an address. They will give you the address, and then they will send you a confirmation once all the paperwork is completed. And it's important, one of the things we learned in our testing is that it can take a couple days for this to be finalized. So you want to wait till you have the confirmation that your address is up and running and functional. And really what it is, it's just a sort of a warehousing system for mail. And they offer all sorts of different services. They can scan your mail for you. They can recycle it. They can forward it, those sorts of things. But what you would like is to have them forward a package that comes to you at that address. So once you have it confirmed, you then contact a telemedicine provider in California. And as I said, there are a lot of these. And a lot of them operate in what we say is an asynchronous way. It's not in real time. So there's no video visit that's required. It's just a form that you fill in with your medical history. They review it on the back end. A clinician reviews it. And if they have any questions, they might text with you. They might call you up, but probably unlikely because most people do qualify. So you fill out the form, you pay the fee, and again, a lot of them do offer discounts if you can't afford the entire cost, but the pricing starts at about $150 and might go up to $250 depending on the provider. And you give them your California virtual mailing address when they ask, where should I send the pills? Because they are, you know, licensed to provide the service in that state, and by law, they need to mail it to you in that state. So they're complying with the regulations that pertain to them by mailing it to your virtual mailbox. Then when, one important thing is if they ask for your billing address, you should give them your billing address in Alabama, because that's what's linked to your credit card or your payment method. And if you give them the address in California, it might not work. You know, your credit card company is not going to recognize that address. So it's fine if you have to show an ID from Alabama, or if you have to show an address from Alabama on your billing. What's really needed is just the California address for the shipping of the pills. So once you do your telehealth consultation, they'll provide you with a tracking number for your medications that are shipped from a pharmacy in the United States. And they're often shipped from a pharmacy in California, so it's a great idea to choose a virtual address in California, because then the pills are close by to the pharmacy, or your mailbox is close by to the pharmacy. So once they get the tracking, you can track when it arrives in your virtual mailbox. And your virtual mailbox also should give you a notice when you have mail. Sometimes they'll send you a picture of it, or they'll just tell you you've got mail, and they'll ask you, what do you want to do with it? Do you want us to open it? Do you want us to forward it to you? You know, how should we deal with this piece of mail in your account? And so then you can choose whether you want to send it to yourself by U.S. Postal Service, UPS, or FedEx. And there might be slightly different fees that apply to each one of those. You can choose how much you want to pay and how fast you need it to get to you. And you do that all online, and you pay the fee. It might be another $10 or so, or maybe $15. So now, let's see, we were at $35 before, so maybe it's $45 or $50. So this is an additional cost. You know, it's not perfect, but you have to jump through all these hoops to set this up, and you have to pay an additional cost to do it. But it is a way we know people are able to access the pills from these restricted states. So you forward it to yourself, and it should arrive within, you know, probably within about a week of when you had the online consultation with the telehealth provider in California. And then you manage the abortion, you take the pills at home. You can always still get help and advice from the telehealth providers wherever you are. It's their responsibility to send the medications to you in the state where they're licensed, but, you know, people move around and they're totally understanding if you happen to be sitting in another place and need to ask them questions about your care.
As you might remember from previous episodes, both now and before Roe was overturned, one of the many barriers for patients trying to access abortion healthcare were the state-mandated requirements, one of them being requiring patients to set up multiple appointments before they could access the abortion healthcare procedure or simply the abortion pills. Now, with telehealth medicine, I wanted to know, did this also require setting up two appointments, especially given that in order to complete an abortion, it requires taking two sets of medication, mifepristone and misoprostol?
Yeah, that's a good question, because in times past, when the care was only available through clinics, there have been some cases where you had to appear at different appointments to get the different drugs. Mm-hmm. But that is largely not happening now, and certainly not happening through telehealth. When you do a telehealth appointment, you will receive the complete package of medications that you need in the mail altogether. So you'll get the one mifepristone pill, which is the first pill that you take. It's just swallowed like a normal medication. And then you'll receive four or sometimes eight misoprostol pills, and those are the second pills that are taken. They're taken a little bit differently. They're not just swallowed. They're dissolved against a mucous membrane, and the provider will have a recommendation as to the best way for you to take those. And those are taken 1 to 2 days after taking the mifepristone. You would get all of those together in the same package from the pharmacy as essentially a kit and with instructions as to which ones to take when and how.
I want to get back to, I understand that this can sound like a legal question, so if you don't have an answer, that's totally understandable. But as far as you know, how does this work in terms of the bans that are exist in current states? So for example, like we're talking about Alabama and other states where telehealth is banned. And what happens, as far as you know, as someone who technically has abortion pills delivered within a state where it is legal to have access, but then forwarding it to a state and receiving it and taking that medication in a state where the pills are banned, how does that work legally? Are you still technically breaking the law, or is that method of forwarding surpassing this law somehow? Like, is there a gray area here where folks are currently able to kind of still get by legally?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's one that we get a lot. Not just about the mail forwarding option, but about accessing pills through alternate routes, you know, like aid access or online pharmacies. You know, there is a big question, can I get in trouble? And is this legal? So it's a really great question, and, you know, one that we take really seriously and try to provide the best information about. Certainly, when you're accessing care through a mainstream telehealth service in a state that allows it, there should be no risk. You're doing everything, you know, everybody's doing everything in the way that is intended. In other states that restrict access to care, it's important to understand that most of the laws in those states pertain to providing the care and not to the people who are having the abortions themselves. There are a couple of states that specifically prohibit self-managed abortion. So in those states, perhaps going to an online pharmacy or getting pills over the border or in another way and taking them to a self-managed abortion, you know, that could be perceived as illegal. But by and large, these other services like aid access as a physician-supported telehealth service, it's just an alternate way of getting the pills and using them. There's a lot of gray area about, you know, whether anybody's doing anything wrong with that. Also, with mail forwarding, we have talked to lawyers, and people have a right to set up a mailbox and use it to forward things to themselves. And providers are complying with the laws that pertain to them. So there is a lot of gray area there, but we don't believe that anybody's doing anything wrong in that instance. Of course, this is all very new and not yet tested. So let's wait and see what happens. Even if somebody's not doing anything wrong, though, we know that people have been criminalized. And, you know, that's just, abortion is a microcosm of our larger justice system in the United States. We know that people in our country are criminalized for nothing, right? And so, and we know that the people who are disproportionately impacted by that criminalization are people of color or people who have lower incomes or youth or trans and non-binary folks. So anybody who already faces systematic oppression is more likely to be impacted by, you know, unjust criminalization. And we know that that has happened with respect to self-managed abortion. And we anticipate that it will increase as states start cracking down on abortion, you know, provision or start passing laws. A prime example of the fact that you can be criminalized even though you haven't done anything wrong in the abortion space was a case that happened a month or so ago in Texas, where a woman was alleged to have self-managed an abortion. She was arrested and put in jail. And the reproductive justice groups said, no, she's done nothing wrong and you need to release her. And they were absolutely right. Texas does not have any laws that criminalize the person who's having the abortion or say that self-managed abortion is wrong. So eventually the district attorney said, well, yes, you're right. She has done nothing wrong. There are no criminal charges. All charges are dropped. But that's just, you know, something that never should have happened. It happens because medical personnel and law enforcement personnel really have no idea what they're supposed to do if they come across somebody who has self-managed an abortion. And they might falsely believe that they need to report that person. And then they do that, and it starts this cascade of unjust criminalization against an individual. So we want to, you know, let people know about that, that it's a possibility. We do know that there have been, you know, probably several dozen people at least who have been criminalized for self-managing abortion over the past 20 years. That's probably an undercount. It's sort of hard to know exactly how many people have, but, you know, any number above zero is unacceptable. So we want people to understand that risk, but we also believe that when people consider all of the risks that are involved in being pregnant when you don't want to be, that it could be a rational decision for somebody to find an alternate source of pills and just use the pills in the privacy of their own home. In fact, we know that tens of thousands of people around the country are doing that, or have been doing that per year over the last couple of years. We do refer people to the Repro Legal Helpline, which is an amazing free and confidential resource that can help people understand, you know, what are the laws in the state that I'm sitting in? How far along am I in my pregnancy? What is it that I want to do? And, you know, you can talk to them confidentially and they will help you assess what's the potential risk so that you can make a decision about your own care with the best information available.
Can you talk about the different barriers that folks face in terms of different communities? I know you've talked a lot about folks who are in states where telehealth is banned. I'd like to talk about ways in which, as you mentioned, Plan C and Aid Access and other organizations are providing online resources for folks and how that is very beneficial for folks in certain communities, like folks who have disabilities, the BIPOC community, folks who are part of the LGBTQ community. Can you talk about how these resources are so necessary because of the bans?
Yeah, that's a great question because it really gets at this essential issue of equity and equity and access to care. You know, the situation in the United States right now is if you have money, you know, you can get an abortion. And that's true in the restricted states now, too, because it means you can travel to another state and you can take time off from work and, you know, you can make all those arrangements. But you know, what if you don't have money, or you live in a rural area, or you don't really have good access to health care, or you can't take time off from work, or you don't have transportation, you can't find child care, you know, all of those types of things that we know working class people are facing, or, you know, anyone really could be facing. And also, what if you haven't been treated well by the medical system and you don't trust them to help you? We know that our, you know, systems of oppression really impact our access to medical care. And, you know, all the folks that you mentioned are at higher risk of not receiving care in the first place due to that kind of, those kinds of systemic oppression. So one of the things that we believe is that these new routes of access to pills do reduce many of these barriers and therefore, you know, increase the equity and access. So, for example, a lot of these telehealth services are much less expensive than clinic-based care. So clinic-based care can be $600, $700, $800. And a lot of these telehealth services start at $150 and will also discount the service if needed. We've been working hard to connect the telehealth providers up with abortion funds that can help cover the difference. And so it really is just based on what you say you can pay. There's no forms to fill out or, you know, anything like that. You just say, well, here's what I can afford to pay, $30. And they'll say, fine, we'll cover the rest. So that's a big thing, is lower overall cost of the telehealth services. It enables you to stay at home. So then you don't have all of these time off from work, transportation, childcare, you know, all of those types of things. And especially important if you're in a rural area, because the travel times can be quite great. And especially important if you're in a state with restrictions, because you might have to go to an entirely different state in order to get care. And then privacy is another thing that could be thought of as an equity type of issue. We know that a lot of members of the LGBTQ community have not been treated well. And also BIPOC individuals have not been treated well when they've gone to their medical providers. And so having these asynchronous care options where you really are just interacting by texting and online gives you a level of privacy that a lot of people really value. So those are a few of the ways that, you know, equity could probably be improved through these telehealth services. But we also recognize that there are likely to be equity barriers too, just inherent in telehealth. And I know that some of the research on telehealth does point out some of these things, that, you know, not everybody has broadband access. Not everybody owns a smartphone. You know, you might not trust this type of system. You might prefer in-person care. So I think in an ideal world, we would want to identify, you know, what are these remaining equity barriers inherent in the system? And there are people who are researching this right now to try and see how we can improve telehealth types of systems for abortion to erase some of those equity barriers. And then I guess the other thing that we didn't really talk about is just this idea that these laws are unjust. And there comes a point in time when you need to look at the laws that we have in our country. And I'm talking specifically about laws restricting access to abortion care, but I'm sure that there are other laws that this would also apply to. But you just have to look at the laws and reject them because they're totally unjust. And we're at that point in a lot of states in the U.S. already, and it's only going to get worse after the SCOTUS decision comes down. So I would encourage people to actively reject these unjust laws and focus on the needs of the person who needs to have the abortion. How can we help them get the care that they need affordably, safely, and without having to fear criminalization? That is really the work that we all need to do.
This is Claire Rosado with KBFM, and you're listening to Row on the Rocks, a limited series podcast about what abortion access looked like in America while Roe was still the law of the land. Music in this segment is Ragtime by Peerless, courtesy of Epidemic Sound. This is the last episode of this limited series. Special thanks to my
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Due to technical problems, the Old Mill Variety Hour Indigenous Peoples Day special did not air on Monday, October 9. Instead, we will be airing the program next Monday, October 16 at 9 a.m. Join the Moles to hear stories, poetry, and commentary on efforts to decolonize and reclaim Indigenous ways of being. Music by Fawn Wood.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in our annual fall membership drive. You can help us meet our $55,000 goal by going to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution today. All donations will be matched up to $14,000 thanks to a generous group of anonymous donors. KBOO's independent programming is only possible with your support.